Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
I was in the office and somebody came in, they were knocking at the door, and I went to the door and they said, somebody is ODing 4 or 5 doors down the street here. I remember going down, stopping halfway there, turning around and coming back because I remembered, hey, we got some naloxone. And when I got on the scene, the guy was dead. He was dead. From what I gathered, there was no heartbeat. He was blue. I gave him the shot. I waited about a minute. And in the meantime, I was doing chest compressions and breathing. And then I gave him another shot. He opened his eyes and all I heard was... I went, holy shit. It was like just the best thing I ever heard.
So that's what it sounds like to save a life. But for any given person brought back from the brink of overdose death, there's a good chance that he or she could be right back in the same position before long. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect from 88.5. Today's show is a close look at how the Northwest is coping with the opioid crisis, and a reckoning with just how daunting the problem really is. We wanted to understand better why opioids have such power over people. What is it about humans that make us so susceptible to the drug's effects and so prone to deadly addiction? So we hit up Charles Chavkin, a professor in the pharmacology department at the University of Washington. He says the key is understanding a chemical in our brains. Endorphins are our natural happy juice, and the brain has a whole series of neurons made just for receiving it.
They're there as kind of antennas. They're very specific. They're tuned to one frequency. The one frequency is the chemical that they've evolved to detect. So they're there pretty much waiting for the right time to fire.
So what happens then when a big batch of opioid molecules roll in?
Well, the receptors are fooled into thinking that it's the endorphins that are telling them that it's time to fire. And what they'll do is they will send the signals as if the endorphins were there. The difference between endorphins and, say, morphine is that when the brain releases endorphins, it's really in a short burst, and then it'll go away. A short burst meaning like a second or a minute or so. But when you take an opium extract like morphine and your blood level goes up and your brain levels go up and can stay up for hours, and the neurons are convinced that there's a very strong, it's like a continual fire alarm going off inside the brain.
Yeah. And how does that, when they're overwhelmed like that, how does that affect normal brain functioning?
Well, all of the effects that you can see of someone who's taken opiates are what you would see. A lower pain sensitivity. They have a strong sense of what we call euphoria, which is that happiness, that dreamy state. So the whole physiology changes.
So how does addiction form?
So when those receptors have been occupied by morphine for an extended period of time, the body, like any other physiologic system, will adapt and will desensitize those receptors. So they will turn down their signaling in a way that will produce tolerance. And the physical dependence means that you are, in order to maintain your physiology, requiring that high level of morphine in your brain and in your blood.
What do we know about why the horrible effects of withdrawal occur? I mean, the nausea. I mean, people really tell nightmare stories about what it's like to be what they call dope sick. Why does that happen?
Well, this physical dependence that I just described is exactly why. So if you think about a teeter-totter, a seesaw, that when the drug comes on one side of the teeter-totter and pushes it down, the physiology restores the balance. Now when the morphine is gone, bam, the teeter-totter tips the other way. At that point, you're feeling the pain, the hyperalgesia, the dysphoria, the gut symptoms. All of those things are withdrawal from the opiate that are there because your body has adapted to the presence of the drug, which is now gone.
So how does, frequent or intense opioid use affect somebody's ability to enjoy other things, the things that normally would have caused a rush of dopamine or endorphins before they were addicted?
that's really the characteristic of the progression to addiction, is that an individual will start being amused and entertained and enjoying a pretty broad range of things in their life. But as the drug becomes a more and more important part of their existence, more important part of their life, their interests really narrow to just opiates. In some ways, that's because the way opiates will influence the dopamine system. Dopamine is one of those chemicals that I described a moment ago, one of those transmitters that's really important in signaling a positive thing in your environment. But what the brain has learned is that the most important thing to activate the dopamine system is now this addictive drug, morphine. And other things which used to activate the dopamine system don't any longer.
For someone who's not had an experience with addiction, it can be hard to sort of understand what's motivating somebody who does have an addiction. Why don't they just stop? Why don't they make different choices? Why don't they take responsibility for their addiction and their health? And I'm just curious, from your point of view, can you give us any insight as to why that is?
I think it's really a common debate in our culture to ask, is drug addiction a choice, or have the drug addicts lost that choice? And there's no doubt that there's an element of choice, at least at the beginning. No one's holding a gun to your head to do that. You will be taking the drug of your own choice. But what we know in the biology is that at some point after an experiencing of that opiate for an extended period of time, individuals can't quit. At that point, it takes more than willpower for those individuals to quit.
Professor Charles Chavkin is the Allen and Phyllis Truer Endowed Chair of Pain Research and a professor in the Department of Pharmacology at the University of Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and on this week's show, stories arising from the opioid epidemic. So as we just heard, opioids can really warp our brain circuitry, and those changes can last a very, very long time. It's a scary idea that once you're addicted, you're just never really safe. And Tarina James has lived that. A quick heads up that this story deals with some difficult subjects that may not be appropriate for kids. It lasts about 10 minutes. Tarina is in her late 40s. She grew up in Yakima and now lives in Seattle. She shared how heroin has shaped big parts of her life story.
I didn't have the greatest growing up. My mom was basically a single mom. She married a couple times, but it didn't work out. And she did the best she could with what she had. Unfortunately, her and I didn't see eye to eye. And I got kicked out of my house when I was 12.
So you were 12 years old and homeless.
Right.
In the chaos of that time, she met a man. And by age 15, she was pregnant. The relationship didn't last. And soon she and her baby moved in with another guy, an older guy with kids of his own and his own drug habit. So one day in May, that guy left his kids with Tarina and took off.
And left me with all three children. I was basically out there for almost 5 days with no car. So on the 19th of May, I was kind of fed up, and I woke up, and I just had a gut feeling that something was wrong. So I had walked to the store several times trying to get a hold of my grandmother. And so I decided, well, you know, I'm going to go put the kids down for a nap, and then I'll try again a little later this afternoon. And I did just that. I was in my kitchen doing my dishes, and I went and checked on my boy and went back to my dishes. And I want to say about 5 minutes went by, and the doorbell rang. I answered the door, and it was my best friend that lived across the street. And she's like, you want to go to the store? And I was like, well, dang, I just put the kids down for a nap not that long ago. I said, but yeah, I guess I can wake him up and we can go again. So I went into the room, waked my son up, and found him on his knees. He had basically been strangled with a necklace.
One of the other kids had tried to lift Tarina's son out of his playpen by pulling on the necklace, which Tarina says she didn't even realize was in there. And by the time she found him, it was too late.
I had just turned 16, and I'd never seen death. I didn't know what death was. So by the time we finally get to the hospital, they put him on life support. On his birthday, May 23rd, 1986, they came in and told me my son was brain dead and that he would never wake up. There was nothing I could do. So I went ahead and agreed to take him off life support. And again, not understanding death, I held him till his heart stopped. I laid him down because I knew at that point I could just tell he wasn't with me anymore. And I ran. And I mean, I ran. I ran all the way to Moxie. And that night, the man that I'm talking about came home. And he had his drugs. I didn't want to feel. And he said he had something that would take it all away. And of course, it took it away. But it also started a really unfortunate life for myself.
So was that really the origin of your addiction struggles?
Yeah, I started shooting heroin and cocaine from that night. And when you're doing heroin, when you're shooting heroin, it's like you're floating on a cloud. That's the only way I can explain it. If anybody can imagine in their mind what that feels like. You don't have a care in the world other than, you know, getting some more of it. But so all your worries, all your fears, all your trauma, it all just kind of goes away for a minute. Until you know, come down off of it, and then you start all over again.
Before long, Tarina was pregnant again, and before her daughter was born, she made a determined effort to get clean. And that worked until her 21st birthday rolled around.
My girlfriend decided to show up with an 8-ball of heroin and set it on my table and tell me happy birthday. And I fought, and I fought, and I fought and tried not to. And then I, you know, did the dumb thing and said, oh, I'll just do it once and it'll be okay. Worst mistake I could have ever made. And then she was taken from me. And then I started fighting and trying to get my, I mean, I ran for a few months, but then I decided, no, I'm going to get my life together, you know, and get my daughter back. So 1991 is when I went into treatment and I never used again for 17 years.
17 years. Long enough to raise a daughter, get married, start a business. She was living a normal middle-class life, though she knew there was a cloud hanging over her head.
I made a big mistake, and rather than getting counseling for my past, I buried myself in my work, my daughter, and my husband. Well, that's great, except for I still didn't deal with that underlying problem. It was still there.
Yeah. So, you're into your 30s. Your daughter is almost fledged, right?
Yeah. And yeah. Life took another twist.
Tarina was having a hard time having more children. She had several ectopic pregnancies where the embryos kept getting stuck in her fallopian tubes. It can be really painful.
I can't even count on my hands how many surgeries to repair my tubes, to clean my tubes, to this my tubes, to that my tubes.
So during the course of your treatment, they were giving you opioid painkillers?
Oh, yes. Fentanyl patches, oxycodone, oxycontin. Now, mind you, I was an addict. But I knew nothing of pain medication and what it could do to you.
So that didn't occur that was a red flag?
No, because the doctor was prescribing it. It was something I needed to take. Now I had a problem. Now I found out I was addicted. And I didn't know what to do. I started buying it on the street.
Pain meds?
Yeah. And one day, I couldn't get anything. And I met the wrong person. On the right day, the right person on the wrong day, however you want to say it. And he said, I can't get you any pain medication, but I can get you some heroin. And so there we go. Back on. I was instantly back on the heroin.
Instantly?
Instantly. One shot. And I was instantly back. Like I'd never stopped. 17 years later. I ended up losing my home. I ended up losing everything all over again.
After 17 years clean, Tarina was back at rock bottom. 3 years later, she found herself in handcuffs being admitted to the recovery centers of King County.
I actually made a collage, you might call it, in there. And that collage told one ugly story. But an ugly story that I was allowed to finally let out. But even then, I still hadn't done enough. And 4 years later, I made a really stupid decision for a very stupid reason. And so there I go again looking for the opioid. This time it was a lot easier to find and a lot, you know, quicker situation. And unfortunately, it sent me on a really ugly road because this time I became homeless in Seattle.
This time, Tarina says she was shunned by her family. And then something just clicked.
This time I decided to try methadone, which I never really believed in methadone before because I thought I was swapping one drug for another. About 3 weeks later, the 16th of October, I just decided that day when I woke up I didn't need to use anymore. It was that quick for me. I was very fortunate, and I was on a pretty low amount of it. So the methadone actually worked, you know, and I didn't feel sick anymore, and I didn't have to go through that process. So it was amazing for me.
So how are you feeling in terms of your addiction now? How, I don't know, where are you at with that, and how do you feel about the possibility of relapsing again sometime in the future?
Well, as I tell everyone, I'm 5 seconds away from a relapse. If I was to tell myself anything else, I'd be lying to myself. Now, with that said, do I have any intention or thoughts that I'll ever use again? No. I'm very thankful, and I don't forget where I came from.
Tarina James is an activist and a student in Seattle. She's studying to become a chemical dependency counselor. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about the opioid crisis in the Northwest. Over a three-month period last year, one emergency room in Everett, Washington, treated 253 people who had overdosed. The most recent state data shows Snohomish County has one of the highest rates of overdose deaths in Washington. One institution that could see this storm brewing years ago was the library. Staff there have been quietly dealing with people using these safe public places to shoot up. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing tells us how Everett librarians are reluctantly accepting their new role as de facto first responders and helping lead the way toward more long-term solutions.
It's 9 in the morning at the Evergreen Branch in South Everett. I'm in a small carpeted room that'll soon be filled with toddlers for story time. Instead of kids, middle-aged women sit in here in folding chairs. Librarians, the people who help you find information. But right now, they're not here to talk about that.
You are all here for a Narcan training today. Does everybody know what Narcan is? Yes? Naloxone is also what it's referred to.
This is Amy Austin. She's an opioid outreach specialist for Snohomish County, and she's here to teach this group of librarians how to deliver a dose of Narcan. If you can get to someone in time, Narcan can pull a person out of a drug overdose and save their life. But first, what does an overdose even look like?
Their skin will be pale and clammy. Their breathing, if they're breathing, will be very infrequent. There'll be a deep snoring or like a gurgling sound, kind of like a death rattle.
Now it's time for the librarians to get comfortable with taking this little squirt bottle, holding the Narcan, and testing out what it's like to shoot it up someone's nose. Library technician Margot June gives it a try on a willing volunteer.
Okay.
Now's your chance.
Okay, so do it so everybody can see. So,
okay.
Yeah, so.
One.
Okay.
Two.
Okay,
three.
It's going to go. Ooh!
And then flip them on the side.
Flip them on the side. So it is just one squirt.
Yes. It has come to this. Librarians getting training on how to reverse a drug overdose. Everett is one of the first library systems in the state to offer Narcan training to its staff, and it's not a requirement, it's voluntary. So far, there's no report of anyone actually dying of an overdose inside of either of Everett's two libraries, but people have been caught shooting up heroin in the bathrooms, used needles have been tucked behind toilets and left around the properties. Librarians suspect that some patrons use the library's computers to arrange drug deals. Librarian Margot June, who's here for the Narcan training, is frustrated by people making her building a part of their drug habit or their business, but she has a lot of empathy too.
My heart is broken to see these people because it's kind of close to home. It could have been my son.
Margot's son was addicted to opioids. She says today, he's clean. Her son's friend wasn't so lucky.
He was a young, promising, smart kid, and he OD'd. And that he was probably 19 years old and came from a, well, good home.
The Narcan training for the libraries is just one small piece of a much larger overdose prevention effort underway in Everett called the Safe Streets Initiative, and we'll get to more on that in a bit. But first, let's meet Abigail Cooley. She's the library's director and gives me a tour of the main branch.
This is probably one of my favorite views from the second floor, looking out over to the open reading room.
The reading room has comfy chairs, floor-to-ceiling windows, live trees. This brick building is in the heart of downtown Everett. It was built in the 1930s, and it is beautiful. We head to the bathrooms. And to make the bathrooms less inviting to hang out in, the library has removed a few things and has made a few adjustments.
So you can see that windows were added on, so there's a little still privacy, but not quite.
Windows to the main windows door. You normally don't see a window in a library or in a bathroom restroom door. Yeah.
And then the stall heights are kind of, I call them like the high school, middle school stall heights. So you still have privacy, but not, you can't really camp out in there. And then we also added the sharps container to prevent people from depositing sharps where maybe they shouldn't be found, and trying to keep people safe.
But having sharps containers also is an acknowledgement that stuff is happening too.
It is, and I think that was the sharps container is a hard thing to wrap your head around, because it is like, are you saying like, you know, by putting those there, are we, you know, we're not condoning it, we're not, you know, like, but we are acknowledging it.
Acknowledging that people are shooting up in the bathrooms just steps away from the resource desk, and they need a place to put their used needles. Rick Maurer, a 63-year-old retired Boeing engineer, has been coming to this library since he was a small boy. When I met him, he was browsing the DVD section.
The library is trying to do the best job they can to not make it a scary place for everybody.
Rick noticed the sharps containers, and he has a pretty matter-of-fact attitude about it.
And unfortunately, it might encourage people to shoot up in the stalls, but at least it gets them a safe place to do it. But not exactly for it and not exactly against it, but if it works, it works.
Around the corner in the children's section, I talk with Margot Dahl. She homeschools her 7 kids, and so she's here a lot. And she's not so sure that putting sharps containers in the bathrooms is the way to go.
If I was in charge, I don't think I would be so accommodating, because it seems like if you just are going to make it easier to use the public spaces for drugs, it's just going to increase drug use instead of, you know, a city has to have rules that work for everybody.
The Everett libraries are not alone in dealing with this problem, far from it. The problem is a lot more dire in other places. Last year, a librarian in Philadelphia prevented at least 6 overdose deaths by using Narcan. A Pennsylvania congressman has written a bill that would use federal money to pay for Narcan training in libraries across the country that are in opioid hotspots. In Everett, I ask Library Director Abigail Cooley if she's worried that her 2 buildings will become de facto supervised injection sites.
Not really, because I feel like people are going to use where they want to use, and I don't think I've seen any increase. I just feel like we have the tools to handle it now. I wouldn't say that's a worry that they're going to rush here as a safe place to inject.
Abigail says the library is a gracious space, and that it needs to be a gracious space for everyone.
I want my families who are coming in here with children, I want them to feel safe and comfortable and welcomed and feel that they can use the library services. But that doesn't mean I can't allow access for people that might have drug addiction issues or don't have homes. I don't think the appropriate solution is to keep a blind eye to things.
If you do your drugs here in our public spaces, we're not going to tolerate that. You will go to jail.
And in jail, in Everett, you'll be offered addiction treatment. This is Hill Kamen. He used to be Everett's lead prosecutor. He could see that prosecuting the problems of addiction, homelessness, and mental illness wasn't going to work.
So I just saw people again and again go to jail, serve time, be put on probation, not show up for treatment, come back, get more jail time.
Today, he heads up Everett's new Office of Health and Public Safety. Hill's main focus is getting all of the city departments to work together to address homelessness, addiction, and mental illness. The effort is called the Safe Streets Initiative. And the work that the Everett Public Library is doing around opioids is done hand in hand with Safe Streets. Hill says it is a constant balance between enforcement and treatment.
You can't just enforce against people and try and use a heavy hand to get them to stop behaving in ways that you don't want them to behave without also having that outreach, without also embedding social workers and our police. We want people to have that doorway into services, that doorway into community, that doorway into health and healing, at the same time that we are saying, there are behaviors that we cannot tolerate in our public spaces because these public spaces are for everybody.
And since the library is that safe place where everyone goes, it's a perfect location to try and reach the people who need the most help and to deliver information, which is what libraries do best. The library has hosted speakers who are experts on addiction. It's brought in medical professionals to help patrons find access to treatment. And it has chosen books about the opioid crisis for community reading events. Margot June, the librarian we met earlier at the Narcan training, says confronting this opioid crisis is testing her patience for people struggling with addiction.
It challenges me to be kind to people because there's another side of me that's like, darn you anyway, what are you doing?
And the library isn't just training its staff on how to use Narcan. Last week, the main branch held its first Narcan training open to the public. 59 people showed up.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Sound Effect is digging into the opioid crisis this hour, and for our next story, we stay in Everett. The city is working to make sure that when someone decides that he or she is ready to get help, like really ready, there's treatment available. And to do that, Everett has created a scholarship. Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestedt has the story.
On the 10th floor of the Wall Street building in Everett, in a very quiet conference room with a beautiful view of the Puget Sound, I meet Caitlin Dowd. She's a social worker embedded with the Everett Police Department, and this isn't where she normally finds herself on a typical day of work.
Kind of our office, so to speak, is the front seat of a police car, essentially. So we do all of our work mostly out of the cars and out in the field, you know, connecting with clients or community members or providers.
And when she says clients,
most of our clients are individuals who are experiencing homelessness, who need some sort of service to assist them in getting stable.
And many are struggling with chemical dependency.
We're seeing lots of heroin, a lot of heroin, and then meth as well. And it's, you know, smoking or IV use or pills. It really depends.
And Caitlin Dowd says that every person is different. For some people, simple detox might do the trick. In some cases, an in-state 30-day Medicaid-funded treatment facility may do. But since 2016, the city of Everett has been part of another avenue towards helping people get the right treatment for the right person by being part of a program called PARI.
The PARI program is the Police Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative. It was a program that was started in Gloucester, Massachusetts by a police chief who, you know, finally was like, you know, we can't arrest our way out of this problem.
What they decided to do was build partnerships with treatment facilities. And very quickly, other police departments around the country started to follow suit, including the Everett Police Department.
So now we have treatment facilities who will scholarship a treatment bed for police departments who have embedded social workers or police departments that are just partnered with PARI and want to get folks help instead of send them to jail.
So it might not be what you typically think when you hear the word scholarship. What it means is that someone who is struggling with addiction can get a bed in a treatment facility free of charge not only to them, but also to the city. The facility itself covers the tab. And that's worth noting because these facilities are private and can normally come with a hefty price tag.
I mean, it could be anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000 to $60,000 a month.
A month. And unlike the 30-day in-state Medicaid-funded treatment facilities, treatment at private facilities can last up to 2 years. So the savings is huge. But there are a couple of catches. First, there is only one participating private facility in the state of Washington in the scholarship program, so if someone wants in, they're likely heading out of state for their treatment. And second, you've got to be serious about wanting to go.
So we usually put them through a couple tests. Like, why don't you go to the doctors and get, you know, an exam to make sure you're all healthy. We don't need to see the results, but do that and let me know when that's done. Why don't you go and get a new ID? If you need help with that, you can let us know. But we try to do a lot to see how much are you going to do to show that you're really, really invested in this.
Okay, so you have to be serious and you have to be ready to go. There are a limited number of beds, so when a bed opens up, you take it. One of the people who was suffering from addiction in Everett is Felicia Davidson. I talked to her via Skype from Florida, where she lives now. I'll get to that in a minute. But she was ready. The story with Felicia's addiction is a common one. She's had severe scoliosis since she was a kid, and in her late teens, her mother gave her some of her medication for the pain. It started with Vicodin and progressed to other pills like Percocet and Oxycontin.
Like, I liked how it took my pain away, but it took, like, all the pain away, like, emotionally and physically. So I was like, hey, I like feeling like this.
And there was emotional pain that Felicia wanted to have taken away following the death of her boyfriend when he was in Hawaii.
He was partying and driving a moped and got hit head on. And they don't have a helmet law in Hawaii or anything. So that's when I was like, it. Like, I don't care. I just want to get high.
Things didn't get a whole lot easier for Felicia after that. She found a new guy, but he was a user too, and that relationship turned out to be abusive. Pills got to be too expensive, and heroin made its way into the picture.
He pawned everything I ever had worth of value. It just goes back to, like, I had no self-respect for myself at that time, and I just put up with it.
Eventually, they lost their house, and Felicia decided she had enough and moved back in with her dad. But the problems didn't stop there. Felicia had reached a point where she found herself asking random strangers in Everett if they had anything she could use to get high.
I ended up meeting this one guy, and I ended up doing something, like, not, like, with, like, no morals. Like, because I was in my dad's car. And, like, he offered me all this and, like, I was hesitant, but in the moment I, like, didn't care. And then I started caring, like, right during, and I was like, no, I gotta go. And so I, like, kicked him out of the car, and I went back to my dad's, and I, like, broke down and started crying. And I was like, you know, that's not me. Like, this, I gotta, like, I'm not about to, like, start, you know, like, who am I, like, you know, hooking up with some guy for drugs? Like, that's not who I want to be.
It was at this point that she realized that she couldn't do it alone. She started going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. A woman at one of the meetings added Felicia to a Facebook group where Felicia saw a post about the scholarship program in Everett. That's when she called Caitlin Dowd, the social worker.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I was crying when I called her the first time, like, and I was just like, I need help.
So we decided to meet at Starbucks and kind of talk about her situation and really what her intentions were as far as getting help. She really needed to go to treatment. She felt that was the best thing for her. So she would need to call or text to check in every day, and she was very motivated, and it was very obvious. You can really tell when someone's motivated.
After a couple weeks, Caitlin was able to find Felicia a bed in South Florida. Felicia packed a bag and was on a plane for treatment in a private facility, a former hotel, at no cost to her or the city. But that's when the real work started.
I mean, physically it sucked. It's just like the body ache for me, like, because I have chronic pain. Like, that was, like, the hardest thing to get used to. The emotionally, like, all the that, like, you avoid by getting high, like, you have to deal with it.
Felicia fought through and completed her treatment, and instead of coming back to Everett, she stayed in South Florida, got a job, a dog, and a place to live. And she stayed clean. She decided to stay in Florida, at least for the time being, partly because the old familiar triggers of Everett wouldn't be there. But there are new problems. Just a week before we talked, a relationship that she had become deeply involved in came to a stop, and Felicia faced the challenge of coping without drug use.
He straight up told me, like, he was going to make me fall in love with him, and he did. And then he just ghosted me and stopped talking to me, and it's really hard because it makes you feel like there's something wrong with you. It's a struggle, but you're not like getting high as a coping mechanism, so you're just dealing with it. But dealing with it involves a lot of tears, yeah, and a lot of like dog snuggles for me. Like, at least I have my dog. I know he loves me. I'm just like immensely grateful for the program and have a life, even though it's a struggle still. Like, the fact that I'm able to wake up and like go about my day and not get high is like a blessing. You can get clean. You don't have to feel hopeless. Like, I mean, even when you feel hopeless, you don't have to get high. Like, it's possible. If I can do it, I know that like other people can do it.
Felicia misses her friends and family back home. She has visions of returning to the Pacific Northwest someday, this time sober and healthy for good.
That story from Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestead. Felicia Davidson is one of 29 people that have gone through the PARI program through the city of Everett in the last 2 years. This is Sound Effect from 88.5. Gabriel Spitzer here, and this week we're focusing on the opioid epidemic. So Everett could be considered ground zero for the opioid crisis in Washington, but you could make a pretty good case that the epicenter in all of North America is just next door in British Columbia. Just 5 years ago, overdose deaths there had been holding steady at under 300 a year. It's about the same as car crashes, but then it spiked. Last year, 1,422 people in British Columbia died of a drug overdose. The crisis in Vancouver has given rise to some pretty radical solutions. You might have heard about the city's legal supervised injection site. It's a clinical model with nurses and service providers on hand. It's a type of place that's being planned for Seattle and King County. But this story is not about that exactly. It's about Vancouver's other supervised consumption sites that have popped up recently. The big difference is that they're run by activists, and in some cases, by the drug users themselves. The birthplace of this movement is a patch of scrubby green called Oppenheimer Park.
It's always been sort of a heart to the neighborhood. A lot of activism started here. This is where the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users formed in 1997.
Travis Lupik is a Vancouver-based reporter and the author of a book on grassroots anti-overdose efforts. He says the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, or VANDU, was co-founded by an activist named Ann Livingston.
Ann went around putting up flyers asking drug users to come and meet in the park, and to their surprise, a few dozen of them did. And eventually, that single meeting in the park became the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. Was the first group of active, hardcore drug users who ever had an actual say in drug policy.
We set off from Oppenheimer Park toward the group's headquarters. In the downtown East Side neighborhood, the epidemic is visible all around us. Worn down people crouch in doorways or shoot the breeze on corners. People mumble offers of drugs for sale as we pass by. On Hastings Street, we head into VANDU's storefront. People inside lounge or doze on mismatched couches. Right by the door is a virtual salad bar of clean needles, tourniquets, candles, everything you need to shoot up. And in the back, in a small room with a wide glass window, is the injection room.
There's three tables, two chairs per table. They have 15 minutes time limit. Nobody ever keeps it.
Hugh Lampkin is one of the supervisors here. He explains how a trained attendant keeps watch and intervenes if someone's in trouble. As he speaks, the attendant hands a large mirror to this wiry guy with a black goatee.
One of the big things is they call it jugging. So you have your juggler at your throat. You know, after a while, it's really hard to find veins on your legs or your arm. So we try to discourage it, but if they want to do it and they're set on doing it, why not give them the tools and the education to do it properly?
The guy with the goatee props the mirror up on a chair, gets down on all fours, and examines his throat closely in the mirror. Moments later, he slips the needle in. Others are using in the same space, either alone or in pairs. Hugh Lampkin says they all have something in common. Nearly everyone here is medicating their pain, either physical or mental. And he ought to know, besides being a supervisor here, Lamkin is also an active heroin user. He's been on and off drugs most of his life, dating back, he says, to a traumatic childhood.
I had an issue where a relative of mine basically tried to drown me when I was about 8. I did my first suicide attempt a couple of months after that. Then I was unfortunate enough to have a pedophile cross my path when I was about 9 or 10, and I never told anybody.
Lamkin grew up in Ontario before he moved here.
My actual plans for coming out here was to do myself in, where I would be far away from my friends and my family.
You came to Vancouver to end your life?
Yeah.
After surviving at least one suicide attempt, Lamkin found himself one day shuffling down Hastings Street. And in front of a doorway, he saw a collection of people that looked, as he put it, like the kind of people he was used to hanging out with. So he poked his head inside, and he discovered Vandu. Before long, he found himself in a peer support group.
I was telling a bunch of strangers my life story, and it was something I had never done before. And after that, just about everybody came up and either hugged me or shook my hand, and it was like you're in a dish, and the glass comes off the dish, and I could actually see and feel this darkness lifting off of me. It's the most incredible thing I ever experienced in my life. You know, and never been the same since.
Your story, as you've told it, seems like a story of hope and of coming back from the brink. I think a lot of people think the only kind of hopeful story for someone who's addicted to drugs is getting clean and getting into sort of a mainstream life. What do you think about that assumption?
I was wrong. People don't have to be clean to have a good life. It's not about the drugs. It's about people's lives and how they see themselves. You know, that's what it's about.
This may be a hard thing to get your head around. Can you talk about a success story that doesn't end in sobriety? Well, Hugh Lamkin and others here say yes. They say active users can have lives that are meaningful and productive, that are free of hepatitis and HIV, that are not a danger to others, and above all, that are at lower risk of overdose death. According to officials in Vancouver, there has not been a single fatality in any of their supervised consumption sites.
Quite honestly, if you put this up against another service provider where you have a PhD or a psychologist, I would put my money in a place like this.
Vandu looks very different from the officially government-sanctioned site, which is run by healthcare workers. Sites like this one live in a legal gray area. They get funding from government health authorities and have arrangements with the cops. They're accepted as a necessary response to an emergency, but technically still illegal. Travis Lupik, the author, leads the way toward another grassroots response to the crisis, the Overdose Prevention Society, or OPS.
The site that we're about to visit now, it's sort of a hybrid. It's not as guerrilla as the Vandu site, but it does run independently, and it does run without healthcare professionals.
On the way, we pass through an outright open-air drug market, which Travis says has been here for years, long before the safe injection sites. It stretches a full block. It's crowded with people milling about and discreetly transacting or selling secondhand goods. OBS started as nothing more than an outdoor tent with a few volunteers standing by with shots of the anti-overdose drug naloxone. About a month ago, they moved indoors.
So we've basically inherited an open room.
This is Ronnie Grigg, the manager here.
That has a leaky ceiling and two bathrooms, one that works. And then we have 12 booths.
Grigg says places like OPS and Vandu are needed with the advent of fentanyl, a super potent and deadly opioid drug that has all but displaced heroin in Vancouver.
It caused frontline workers to have to leave a clinic facility and to be running up and down streets, alleys, sidewalks. One overdose that I attended to, the police referred to Insight staff as the first responders.
At OPS, the stainless steel booths are all full, and it's all men here. I meet a guy named Darren with that prematurely aged look, eyes sunken, cheeks gaunt. But his hair is carefully combed and gelled, and his clothes look like any other 20-somethings. He agrees to talk and then proceeds to spill his whole life story in about a minute.
I was on the streets using, and my girlfriend, Brandy, she had 6.5 months clean, and she pulled over to the side of the road and did a shot, and she injected and died. So I went out pretty hard. And I shoot a lot of heroin every day, and I'm really sad and depressed, and it's it gave me false self-esteem and took everything away from me. I'm planning on stopping on Tuesday for good, hopefully. This is a great place. Ronnie saved me a couple days ago. I did a shot of meth and I was crying, and these guys really care about you here. They really do. Without this place, people would be dead all over.
Around the corner is another part of OPS. It's an outdoor pop-up awning where people can smoke drugs, opioids, meth, crack. They say it's the only supervised site of its kind in North America. Manning the entrance is a tall, rail-thin guy named Cameron. His story of addiction is an all-too-familiar one.
Originally, I was on medication, pills, and sadly, BC is partially against pills, and I still get the pain, so I had to go to heroin, no choice, unfortunately.
So you had been like a professional, you had a career and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got an economics degree. Business-wise, I was doing well, $500,000 a year.
When I explain to Cameron what I'm reporting on, he asked me a question. Do you think that these sites are good or bad? It turns out Cameron has mixed feelings about it.
Basically, it's helping, but at the same time, it's allowing people to take advantage of the situation. Like, because they know their life is not in danger, or they believe it isn't anyway. So people know that if they go overboard, they can be brought back.
Cameron has attended to his fair share of overdoses, but he says lately, he's found the experience really troubling.
I tend to stand outside of the overdoses as much as possible. Whether you see it or not, it does. It affects you when you see somebody that's almost dead and he gets up and then he does it again.
That gets at a big question. Do sites like these actually make things worse? As we wind down our tour, author Travis Lupik says there's data on that question. Several studies of this neighborhood have found that after the first supervised injection site opened, littering, injecting in public, and transmission of disease all stayed flat or decreased.
I mean, we saw a lot of people injecting drugs today, and all of those people were going to be injecting those drugs no matter what. So I think it makes a lot of sense to let them inject them in the places that we visited, where they're getting clean water instead of using a puddle, where they're getting a fresh needle instead of using a dirty one, and where there are people trained in overdose response to catch them if they fall.
One statistic that hasn't turned the corner yet, overall overdose deaths in British Columbia. Again, more than 1,400 people died last year. But the province's chief coroner said if not for these types of harm reduction efforts, the death toll could be 3 times as high. That's it for the show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our intern is Janae Janik. We had help this week from Shane Mailing. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Thanks to Travis Lupik for help with our Vancouver story. You can find a link to his book, Fighting for Space, at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. You can find our podcast on iTunes or the NPR One app, and we always appreciate ratings and reviews. Come on back next week when we tackle pet projects. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.